Accession number 18802, Reel 30.
Brigadier Cowan, Reel 30. You were saying, I think, that there had been a gap between appointments, Secretary of the Hospitality Fund.
Yes. By the time I came along, as I say, the chap retired at the end of March. And by the time I came along in September, there had been a six-month gap. And there had been a six-month gap the previous occasion they wanted to find a replacement. And so it's apparently not a job that's easy to fill. And anyway, I inquired, you know, how long I could stay. And I was virtually told, as long as your face fits, and you'll be on probation, shall we say, for a year, as long as your face fits, you can stay more or less as long as you feel like it until you drop. And so I interpreted that to mean, well, certainly to 65 and possibly to 70. And they said, fine. And apparently the civil service trade unions had always accepted this was a unique job and that, you know, the secretary could stay indefinitely, which is, you know, not the normal form. Anyway, that was the basis on which I was hired. When I arrived, I was told that there'd been hell to pay with the new government, Mrs. Thatcher in particular, who was very dissatisfied with what was done for Number 10. Lord Carrington was dissatisfied because A, he wasn't pleased with what he was getting, and B, Mrs. Thatcher complained to him every day. Lord Soames was dissatisfied because Mrs. Thatcher and Lord Carrington complained to him more or less every day, and he, as the civil service, was responsible for the civil service as a whole, and therefore was responsible indirectly for government hospitality, although Paul Chanham was immediately responsible. So one way and another, there were some aggravated ministers. My predecessor, who I think had been badly advised and had chosen to fight some of these complaints on ground that was not of proper choosing, and I've always worked on the basis you only fight, you know, when it really matters, and that otherwise you negotiate and try and sort of meet people's requirements and wishes, that you fight to the death on big stuff, things that really matter, policy things. And so he had been complained about ever since the new lot came in, and eventually he said, look, I don't have to put up with all this. I'm off. I'm going. I'm not prepared to accept all these rebukes. And so I had to look into all that. An outside consultant had been set up, allegedly, to see whether it would be a good thing to employ, government hospitality to employ, its own brigade of chefs and what you might call a small brigade of waiting staff. And this had been set up before I got there, and the report was there when I got there. And so I, obviously, as one does when one arrives somewhere new, I talked to everybody, and I talked to the heads of sections in particular, and they all said that, you know, that the, quite apart from all these complaints, which had aggravated my predecessor so much, there had actually been a lot of quite good stuff done, and other ministers were entirely satisfied and produced some correspondence to prove it. And so I then said, well, now what about this damned consultant's report, which went far outside its terms of reference and talked about rearranging responsibilities and organisation of government hospitality, having answered the first question, saying, the proper question, saying, no, it should not employ its own brigade and so on, because it wasn't a cost-effective way of using people. There wasn't a regular flow of things. Sometimes, you know, you did 11 things in 2 days, and sometimes you went 6 days with nothing. And so it wasn't really a proper thing, and I said, well, that sounds sensible to me. Anyway, I eventually trotted along to Lord Soames and said, hey, you know, you asked me to come and tell you what I thought about this report. And I said, I don't like it. I don't think it's valid, etc., etc. And very sensibly, he said, look, we've hired you. Use the bits you think are helpful and forget the rest. So I said, thank you very much. That's all I wanted to hear, and pushed off again. And really operated on that basis ever since.
Who actually controlled the Government Hospitality Fund? Who did answer to?
There is a minister in charge who is appointed.
And then what department is he from?
There's no set department. In recent years, he has come from the department which parented Government Hospitality. Now, when I say parented, produced its staff, produced its finance, and so on. Its budget, its estimates, and so on. And that was all a convenient way of doing business. Now, when Mrs. Thatcher woke up one morning in November 1981 and said, let there be no more civil service department, that, from my point of view, put the cat up absolutely amongst the pigeons, because, you know, who do we go to?
Had the civil service department been the parent then?
Yes.
It had.
It had. And the original parent was the Treasury.
Yes.
Up until 1968. That was from 1908 to 1968. 1968 to 1981, the Civil Service Department was the parent. 1981, or 1982 actually, it became the Foreign Office. Now, the Foreign Office actually had been angling to get control of GHF for some years. And when we went to the first meeting to discuss the handover from the Civil Service Department to the Foreign Office, the chairman of the meeting, who knew nothing about us at all, but was operating from a brief, said, now we propose to put you under protocol and conference department. I hope that's satisfactory. Whereupon I banged the table and said, it's wholly unsatisfactory. In no way did I leave the Northern Ireland office to become just some tame old division in somebody else's setup. I'm an independent organisation, and I intend to remain an independent organisation. And furthermore, it is your responsibility to look after us on the basis that we serve all departments equally and impartially. Well, that, not surprisingly, brought the meeting more or less to a conclusion. Anyway, the next day, the chief clerk said that the permanent secretary is a very busy man. He's asked me to take on the responsibility of sort of being a parent for GHF rather than him doing so. Is that all right? And I said, yes, absolutely fine. But, you know, I do need to be assured that I'm going to retain independence and that the finance department is going to look after me properly and so on. There's been a pest transfer from the Civil Service Department, and, you know, we expect to be treated the same as we've always been treated. And that more or less happened. It's, I think, beginning to change now because more and more pressure is coming on money and resources generally. And I talk quite often to my successor, and I think he's having problems. But how it'll all come out in the wash in the end, I don't know. But I suspect it won't be to his advantage.
How large was your staff at Government Hospitality Fund?
We were a total of 25, including me. We were made up of a function section dealing with meals and receptions, which had a head, a deputy head, and five others. A visit section, which dealt with incoming visits for presidents, ministers, well, and the occasional royal, but mainly ministers and presidents. And that was a head, a deputy head, and two. An account section of, from memory, two, really bookkeeping rather than accounts.
Yes.
Two messengers and five government butlers, a head, a deputy head, and three others, who were responsible for setting up all meals and running all meals. And, you know, the arrangements for the table and the service and everything, all meals that were done on our premises as opposed to in a hotel. I think Jennifer will take it. She will. And It's a wonderful sounding title, a government butler, but they do a wonderful job. And
were they, in a sense, catering managers?
Their official title is catering manager now.
Yes.
When I first arrived, they were called government butlers. They were paid some ridiculous arrangement, a retaining fee of some sort, and so much for each function they attended. And I forget, but they were very low. They were treated the same as messengers. And so I said, you know, this absolutely won't do at all. These are high-grade people we're talking about. Yeah. And they eventually became catering managers. The head man is a catering manager one, the deputy a catering manager two, and the other three a catering manager three. And they are paid very well because they get a lot of overtime because, you know, they're late at night quite often. And the head man is paid slightly better than HEO is. So, you know, they can't complain. We've done them very well. But having said that, they work like blacks, day in and day out. And apart from their outside duties, they're responsible for the wonderful government cellar and looking after that and keeping it clean and tidy and properly binned.
Did you have cellar men as well as...
No, these
fire butlers did everything.
Yeah. Mm. I mean, the head butler is also the cellar master.
Where had they been recruited from, these five experts?
When I arrived, the head butler, going back one stage from answering that question, when my predecessor left in March 1980, his deputy was going at the same time to retire, and the head butler had gone at the same time in the same month to retire. And so these were three key people all leaving at once. The chap who took over was the then deputy secretary, who became, you know, the acting head man. But he'd only been at the deputy for a month or two, because up till that time he'd been head of visits. He was brilliant, I understand, at visits, but he wasn't all that brilliant about being a deputy. And to be honest, he had a great whiffly moustache. He looked rather like an Edwardian clubbable gentleman, he looked like. And I think his mind operated at about that speed, too. But he was terribly nice, and he served me very well and helped to see me in and so on. But, you know, he wasn't brilliant. But having been landed with his job, doing everything himself, suddenly from nothing, more or less, it practically killed him. I mean, and I mean that literally, because soon after I arrived, I mean, he obviously wasn't well, and I sent him off for medical, and he had to leave on medical grounds rather than retire, which he would have done in about 2 years' time, which was all very sad, but I'm sure it was right and beneficial to him because he's still alive, which I don't think he would have been otherwise.
He was working himself to death, was he?
Yeah, because he'd been put into a job that was beyond his capabilities.
But I was asking about where the butlers were recruited from. What was your source of...
The one who retired just before I got there was a man called Pettifer, and he'd been a butler or valet or something to Queen Mary at one stage, and so he had a good background. The guy who was head butler when I arrived, had been a railwayman, both in East Africa on the one hand and I think British Rail on the other hand. And so how he became a butler, I haven't the faintest notion. The number three was, technically, he was quite good, but he was a rogue, so he had to go. The number four, I forget who he was, but I think he was retiring. And the number five, he eventually finished up on the front pages of the Daily Mirror and various other papers, being photographed outside number 10 because he'd retired because he didn't want to or something. He'd been told he couldn't stay on or something, which is perfectly true. He couldn't, and he wasn't a very good butler. But he was full of his own importance, and he was terribly good at chatting up ministers and so on, but he wasn't actually very good. And so the team, when I arrived, was weak. And we gradually sort of strengthened it. And now it is very high grade.
Where did you get them from? Did you get them from the World of International Hotels or from private service? Or
the
from
man
other...
who became the head shortly after I got there, no, about a year after I got there, to replace the railwoman, he came from the Draper's Company, where he'd been the equivalent there. And he was very unsure of himself when he first arrived, but he became very good indeed. And, of course, he helped train the rest. The number two, as he became, and is now the number one, I interviewed, along with other people, but because the job is what it is, I mean, I had the main say of this board. He appeared as an unemployed waiter. No, unemployed sub-manager, I think he'd been, at a hotel in Devon, somewhere in Exeter. And the choice was between him and one other. There were quite a few people applied for the job, but the choice was between him and one other. And I was quite torn, but eventually there was something about this fellow. He presented very well. He looked good. He looked the part. And I thought to myself, this chap is going to, in the long run, will be better than the other one. So we took him. And he took to it very quickly. And now he is the head butler. And I said to him the other day, you know, I remember you coming for an interview. And I remember, you telling me you were unemployed. And we took a gamble, and here you are. And he's very pleased, and he does it very well. The others now, two of them have been there a longish time now, and I can't remember where they came from, but they came through a board. The fifth one was recruited, I think, just after I left. We had one who was only there a few months, who came from the Cavalry and Guards Club. He was the assistant manager, or whatever it's called there. And in theory, a very good background. And because the chairman of the board, who came from the parent department, I was just a member of the board, and when we sort of clocked up the scoring of these various people, that chap scored best because of his background and his current job. And so, with some misgiving, I said, okay, well, we could take him, but I'm not sure he's going to fit. And sure enough, he didn't fit. And he didn't fit in with the team. He had no idea of working in a team at all. And fortunately, he applied to go before we could sack him. And he was only there a few months.
You were saying that when you arrived, that Lord Carrington and Mrs. Thatcher had been very critical of the fund, and in particular of the food. What had gone wrong? What were their specific complaints?
I don't know. I don't think I had any specific complaints in my time. I mean, I was just told that they were unhappy about the food. I'm going back to my original interview. The food and its service is bloody awful. What are you going to do about it?
What did you do about it?
Well, the first thing I did about it, which actually was quite crafty, and really solved my problem in one go, was there's a good lady called Lady Ampthill, who is French, and she's the wife of Lord Ampthill, who's in the House of Lords. And she ran a small catering business. She was a friend of Lord Carrington and various other ministers. He enjoyed her food, and so I hired her as a caterer. Normally, we took bigger people, but she was a very small caterer. A small place in Battersea was her headquarters. But she cooked brilliantly. And she, of course, came and did it herself.
She did the cooking personally.
She did the cooking personally. And, of course, the style of her cooking was exactly what Lord Carrington wanted. And so he said, this is wonderful. This is absolutely what I was looking for. And indeed, in front of me one day, he said to Dennis Healy, who was one of the guests at lunch, he said, Dennis, GHF is transformed. It's absolutely wonderful. And here's the guy who's done it, sort of thing. So I said, well, you know, I tried not to blush. He said, everything's absolutely fine. And it was entirely due to this woman and her cooking. Now, because Lord Carrington was satisfied, because we'd done something about sort of tarting up the arrangements for number 10, Lady Thatcher was directly satisfied, although not perhaps wholly so, but more or less so. And, of course, because Lord Carrington was no longer bothering her with his complaints, she accepted everybody else was happy. And so we did actually do quite a lot at number 10 to improve things. And we got on to two specific caterers who were used there, rather than a sort of a gaggle of them.
So it's a case of contracting to a great extent, was it?
I mean, everything we did was contracted.
Yes.
We didn't have a cook on the premises of our own. Everything was contracted. And the caterer was responsible for producing the cook, the kitchen staff, the kitchen equipment, and the waiting staff, not to mention, you know, the trays and things to take them round. We produced the glass and the china, which was all sort of with proper crests on and beautiful stuff, and silver, beautiful stuff, all of which we produced.
And the wine.
And the wine, which of course is internationally famous.
Who actually funded you and provided you with money to keep your wine cellar up and pay the contractors?
The funding is done by the parent department. And so when I arrived, it was the Civil Service Department. Like any other part of the government, we produced estimates. The estimates I found when I got there had not been all that detailed. I produced very detailed estimates indeed, and tried to split it down between things that were specific to our routine and were going to happen year in and year out, and things that were additional in, you know, things like European summits, G7s and G8s and those sort of
contingencies.
Things.
Contingencies.
Contingencies, which we knew would be very expensive, but only happened every so often. Mm. And at that time, I was funding them, and so I made provision for them. Now, very sensibly, the parent department funds them direct, and GHF charges that department for what it provides for them. But it means the conference as such is funded from the same source as from the hospitality.
You mentioned that you did some catering at number 10, and you mentioned Lancaster House. What other venues did you have for functions?
As far as government houses are concerned, the main Lancaster House is the main one, mainly because it's so versatile. And it can take considerable numbers, and it can take three or four different functions going on at the same time, provided you know you organise it properly. Admiralty House, which can take a small number of people, I think it's up to 24. Number one, Carlton Gardens, which is the Foreign Secretary's London residence, that takes up to about 24. The Banqueting House in Whitehall, takes to eat about 200, and reception probably about 300 or 400. Those, I think, are the government houses I can think of. The otherwise, you go more or less anywhere you feel like. I mean, I can remember, for instance, Mrs. Thatcher, one of the summits. The foreign secretary took his dinner to the Royal Society of Arts. Mrs. Thatcher took her dinner to the fifth floor, I think it was, of the... What's that gallery called? It's a gallery just around the corner from the National Gallery.
National Portrait Gallery?
National Portrait Gallery, yes. Brilliant room. I mean, absolutely super room for the purpose. And Reagan and people were highly impressed by the whole setup. But, you know, we had to take everything in. And sometimes in these places you have to take in a field kitchen. because, you know, the facilities don't exist. So those sort of places we went to. The Tower of London we went to once. Hotels we go to fairly regularly.
When you used hotels, did you use your own caterers or did you ever employ the
hotel
staff?
Yes, the hotel did its normal stuff.
Yes.
And we used hotel wine as well. But then you go to outside places like Ditchley Park, where I remember an Anglo-German summit. Wadston Manor, which is a Rothschild house, where we did an Anglo-French summit, and Mitterrand was enchanted.
Did you manage to give him autolands?
Did we?
Give him autolands.
I can't remember what we did. I absolutely can't remember, but I do remember the whole thing was a great success. And although we were proposing to produce some very excellent claret, Lord Rothschild insisted on producing something out of his own cellar. And so we got some Lafite, I suppose it was, 1946 or something. So that was all right.
Bakshi?
Yes. Mind you, I had to say to the Prime Minister, look, before you accept that, you must be absolutely clear what you're laying yourself open to. Mm. You know, that, you know, it is a gift. And do you accept it or don't you accept it? Bearing in mind what people could say. And you see, I found that if I didn't say those sort of things, nobody else did.
It just passed over.
Yeah, and I noticed in the paper the other day, I think it was in the Telegraph, hoo-ha about Macmillan at Chequers charging the government for government hospitality for something that they'd done for him, which should have, was a party occasion. And, you know, once or twice I got myself to the stage of saying, look, I'm very sorry. This is a party occasion, and absolutely, GHF cannot be involved.
Not only
it won't pay, it can't be involved.
Because it was not a government occasion as such.
Exactly, it was a party occasion.
Another charge to which you might have been vulnerable, which I seem to remember being made in the newspapers as a unnecessary expense and extravagance and willful luxury and providing lunches or dinners for official visitors.
Well,
hosts. Do you remember, was any of that sort of trouble in your time?
I think it's one of those things that's always there as a problem, or a potential problem. I think I've seen something in the papers fairly recently about it. I think you've got to decide, I mean, I or my successor have got to decide, and secondly, ministers have got to decide, the standard at which you require to entertain visiting ministers. Now, if you wish to impress them, and if you wish it to be of a proper standard, the standard we were producing was high, it was not extravagant, and indeed, whenever I was talking to the caterers and to other contractors, I said, look, every penny I spend is public money. What I'm looking for from you is very high standards. I want Rolls-Royce service for Ford prices. That was roughly the message I gave to them. And by and large, we achieved that. Now, if you're producing butler service, and if you're producing meals for 24, 30, 40, 50 people in very high-grade surroundings and so on, inevitably it's going to cost. It's a question is the cost effective or isn't it? And I can only say that having watched foreigners come into Lancaster House and look with awe at the ceiling as they just arrive and they look around them and literally look with awe and say, gosh, if only we got something like this for our government to entertain in. And then you get, I can remember the first time Prue Leek did a meal for government hospitality, which was well into my time. And it was a very simple meal. It was chicken, I can't remember what the first course was, but it was chicken and leek pie was the main course with suitable veg and a fairly ordinary put, if I remember. It did so happen there was some 1961 claret with it, which obviously didn't do any harm. But this was a meeting which was sponsored by the Home Office on the one hand, and I forget who the other department was, and they rang me up afterwards and said, that lunch was a tremendous success. We cancelled a meeting, an official formal